te vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Avyakta lingo vyaktarto. Avyakta lingo vyaktarto. Manishyun matabalavad. Manishyun matabalavad. Kavir mukavad atmanam. Kavir mukavad atmanam. Sadrishya dashayanunam. Sadrishya darshayanrinam. Avyakta lingo vyaktarto. Amanishyun matabalavad. Kavir mukavad atmanam. Sadrishya darshayanrinam. Manishyun matabalavad. Children? No. Okay. Avyakta linga. Whose symptoms of sannyas are unmanifested. Is that correlating between what I'm reading and up on the board?
Yes.
Okay. Vyakta artha, whose purpose is manifested. Manishi, such a great saintly person. Unmata, restless. Balavat, like a boy. Kavihi, a great poet or orator. Mukavat, like a dumb man. Atmanam, himself. Sa, he. Drishya, by example. Darshayat, should present. Ninam, to human society. Translation. Although a saintly person may not expose himself to the vision of human society, by his behavior his purpose is disclosed. To human society he should present himself like a restless child. And although he is the greatest thoughtful orator, he should present himself like a dumb man. Please repeat. Although a saintly person may not expose himself to the vision of human society, by his behavior, his purpose is disclosed. To human society, he should present himself like a restless child. And although he is the greatest thoughtful orator, he should present himself like a dumb man. Although a saintly person may not expose himself to the vision of human society, by his behavior, his purpose is disclosed. To human society, he should present himself like a restless child. And although he is the greatest thoughtful orator, he should present himself like a dumb man. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. A great personality, very much advanced in Krishna consciousness, may not expose himself by the signs of a sannyasi. To cover himself, he may live like a restless child or a dumb person, although he is the greatest orator or poet. I'm trying to figure out how this verse and this section of the Bhagavatam applies to Prabhupada. And Prabhupada was obviously, I mean, what we're talking about here, what this chapter or this little section of the 13th chapter of the 7th canto is talking about is the symptoms or the nature or identity of the avaduta. And there have been many great avadutas in our line, in our tradition. Sukadeva Goswami was an avaduta. He would, as we all know, we've heard many times, he would just freely travel naked, not wearing any clothes. He wouldn't speak to anybody. Everybody thought he was a madman. He was crazy. They just didn't know what to make of him. Even when he, of course, the famous story, when he passed the river where the gopis were taking a bath and they had no clothes on, the gopis, because they are so highly elevated in their spiritual vision, and didn't even take notice and cover themselves. Ordinarily, if a man had invaded their privacy, they would have freaked out and immediately covered themselves and hidden themselves and run away. But when they saw Sukadeva Swami, they just said, "Oh, that's just Sukadeva. Don't worry about him. He doesn't even see us." Sukadeva Goswami didn't even see the living entities or the external features of the living entities. He was oblivious to all of these man or woman, black or white, kshatriya, brahmana, sannyasi, whoever, animal. Didn't make any difference to Sukadeva Goswami because he did not see any of these external bodily features of the living entities. Sukadeva Goswami was so advanced, of course, as we all know, the son of Vyasadeva, that he was always fully immersed 24/7, every second, in the pastimes of the Lord, thinking about Krishna all the time, whether awake or sleeping or any condition of life. He was oblivious to everything. And, of course, he's only one example. In this chapter, what Prahlad Maharaj is going to do, he's on a field trip with some of his friends after the whole drama of Hiranyakashipu appearing from the pillar and killing his father and wiping out all the other demons and so forth. After everything settled down, everybody came and offered prayers, and finally Prahlad offered his prayers, and Lord Nrisimhadeva was pacified, and everything settled down, and everything kind of went back to normal. So Prahlada's sort of moving on with his life at this point in a subsequent section of the Bhagavatam. And so in his normal life as the king of this planet that he was given, I can't remember the name of the planet that he was given by Lord Nrisingadev. It's in here, but he was thinking one day, well, let's go on a field trip. So remember when we were all in school, we're going to go on a field trip, and everybody have to get their parents to sign the permission slip, and then we'd go to the planetarium, or we go to the zoo, or we'd go to the library downtown, all of these tremendously exciting places that everybody, the only field trip I ever remember that I looked forward to was the end of the year picnic at Matheson Hammock Park in Key Biscayne. It was a beach party, in other words. That's the one that everybody looked forward to. Otherwise, nobody really had much interest in going on these dull, boring field trips and having some tour guide explain, well, this is Jupiter and this is Saturn, and over here we have such and such, or the cavemen, or whatever the venue happened to be. But on this field trip, Prahlad Maharaj said, well, let's go out and let's study some saintly personalities. That was actually the purpose of his field trip. Let's go find some saintly personalities and let's study them and let's learn from them. So in the course of their field trip, they came across this very, very unusual Avaduta. I don't know if the name of the Avaduta is actually given. Does anybody know the name of this Avaduta that they found in the forest? Anyway, it was some person. It was obviously a great sage, and this sage was living in the forest, naked, on the ground, just wild in the jungle, with no clothes, no food, no shelter, no association, nothing. And he was compared to a python, the python Avaduta. And that is because he just stayed in one place. And actually refers in several places here. He said the people from his former life didn't even know who it was. When they would see him, they would look and, is that so-and-so? Could that really be him? Because they couldn't recognize him. But we do know from those references that he did have some kind of a former life which he renounced, and he went to the forest. The four Kumaras or other, they're also Avadutas, because the Avadutas, what they are, is they're great, advanced, the highest personalities, highest advanced personalities who take these forms which sort of camouflage or conceal their real identity, such as the four Kumaras. When people would see the four Kumaras, they would think, oh, four little boys. These four little kids, how could these little kids be such advanced sages as we find out that they are? They're also Avadutas. Another famous Avaduta is Judd Bharat, probably the most well-known as an Avaduta. Of course, we remember the story of Judd Bharat. He was a great king. He was very advanced and very learned. And he was very fixed up. And he would do severe austerities and follow all the principles. And then one day he was out in the forest meditating, and I guess he was in his bhajan kuti performing his oblations and his prayers and his meditation. And there was a deer being chased by a lion. And the deer was pregnant, and the deer became panicked and jumped across this river to the other side where Judd Bharat, or Bharat Maharaj at that time, was meditating, and it broke his meditation, and he saw this deer, and the deer was so scared and so frightened that the deer just died on the spot out of fear. But the deer was pregnant, and it gave birth to the little baby deer, or the doe, or whatever it was. And Judd Barat saw that there was this helpless deer, or Baratamar saw that there was this helpless deer, and he became very attached to the deer, even though he was such an exalted and such a advanced devotee. Somehow or other, this little deer, who would imagine? It's not like some gorgeous heavenly goddess walked by, which we've seen many examples of this, where a great sage will be, a great yogi will be allured by some gorgeous demigoddess, will attract that sage, and that sage will fall down into householder life, and et cetera, et cetera. So this wasn't even a beautiful woman or a great, magnificent goddess that would have been irresistible to anyone other than the greatest, most advanced devotees such as Srila Prabhupada or Haridas Thakur or someone on that level. It was a deer. It was a little tiny deer. Of course, this is not so surprising because, at least in the Western countries, I always find it quite interesting how people become so attached to their domesticated animals, their pets. The dog in this country, it's dogs and cats. In other countries, what we call pet, they call dinner or lunch or whatever it may be, because it's all relative. But somehow or other, in this country, people are incredibly attached to their animals, to their dogs or their cats primarily. Of course, there are some others. They have all kinds of bizarre pets that people become attached to. And I have theories about why people become attached to certain kinds of animals. And that might be somewhat obvious because sometimes you'll see somebody walking their dog, particularly an elderly person or an older person like myself, and they'll have a dog and they'll be walking it and you'll look at them and say, boy, there's a similarity there. For some reason, these two living entities look amazingly alike, and you can immediately extrapolate from that. Well, maybe that's because that human being is going to be, they're going to reverse roles in their next life. And they're getting ready by taking on the features of the body. And this is another very interesting point that's brought out in this chapter about Prahlad Maharaj. Because when Prahlad Maharaj saw this avaduta, this very unusual avaduta, he immediately knew that it was a saintly person. Even though no one else knew the identity of this saintly person, the pure devotee is actually able to analyze the physiological, there's a word for it, the physiognomy. Professor, is that the right word? What's that? Okay, if that's what Prabhupada uses, that's good enough for me. The physiognomy of living entities. Now, and he can actually understand who that person is and what that person is actually thinking. And I was thinking about this because whenever I had the opportunity to be with Srila Prabhupada, I always got very nervous. I was always very nervous. I was never really comfortable, unless there was a big crowd and I was in the back of the room or and inconspicuous or something like that. Because whenever I went into a small little darshan or a small walk, or even on a few rare occasions when I was in the room with Prabhupada himself and nobody else was there, or maybe just a servant, I would get very nervous because I always felt Prabhupada is looking right through me. He knows exactly what I'm thinking. He knows my mind. He knows what a fallen dog I am. He knows I'm only here to build up my own self-prestige by saying, oh, I'm with Prabhupada, or I saw Prabhupada today. I wasn't there to really take advantage of his association, but for other reasons of peer prestige or status or something else. I could always get that feeling. I always had that very uncomfortable feeling, oh, Prabhupada knows exactly what I'm thinking. He knows exactly where, you know, how polluted my heart is, and it would make me very uncomfortable. I don't know if anybody else felt that way, but I always felt that way. And it's not that Prabhupada was psychic or could read my mind or read someone's mind and knew exactly what we were thinking, but he could actually analyze by his expertise. The pure devotee is expert in understanding both Rajavidya and the word for the material knowledge. What's that called? Anyway, spiritual and material, expert in both. And, of course, there's a whole chapter of the Bhagavad Gita simply on the three modes of material nature. And that's exactly what our body is composed of. Our body, yes, it's earth, water, fire, air, et cetera, et cetera. But the mixture, the particular mixture, and the particular way that these elements are combined is all dictated by the three modes of material nature. So therefore, in a perfect society, in Varnashram, in real Varnashram, God-centered Varnashram, where Krishna is actually the goal and people are actually Krishna conscious, then the Varnas and the Ashrams are actually divided up according to these modes. The Brahmanas are in pure goodness. The Kshatriyas are, what, a mixture of passion and goodness. The Vaishyas are passion and something. And the Sudras, of course, are pure ignorance. But the Varnas and the Ashrams are dictated, or they're divided up, not in terms of caste. Oh, you're born in this family, or you're born in that family, and this is your job or that job. It's based on the modes of nature. And we get a body based upon the karmic calculations, or the calculus of the three modes of material nature determine the specific type of material body that we obtain in each birth, in each life. And it's just quite astonishing when you think about the scientific view that everything is here by chance, and that there was a certain combination of chemicals that interacted in a certain way. But if that's the case, if all of this stuff is so, science means predictability, doesn't it, Dhritakarma? I mean, isn't what the scientists are trying to do? They're trying to, based upon all their calculations and formulas, they're trying to come up with some formula for predictability, the cause and effect. If you do this, then this is what you will get. So it's kind of based on predictability. So if they're so advanced in this predictability, then why doesn't every single human being look the same? Why isn't every single living entity and every single species identical? Where does this variety come from? What is the origin of all of the variety? If you examine any two people, even identical twins, there's so many differences in their genetic makeup and their personalities. Their eyeballs are different. Their ears are different. Their internal organs are different. Everyone is unique because ultimately there is individuality. Everyone is an individual. Everyone, you are who you are, and I am who I am, and you are not me, and I am not you. Nor at any time in the future shall we all be each other. So we're always going to be who we are, whoever that may be. And so we each get this genetic makeup that's dictated by the three modes of material nature. So when Prahlad Maharaj came across this Avaduta who was just laying in the forest, naked, like a python. He immediately understood by analyzing this material formula based upon the three modes of material. Oh, yes, this is actually a very advanced soul. And so even though this Avaduta would never have otherwise revealed himself to Prahlad Maharaj, anybody else, he would have just played deaf and dumb, just like Judd Bharat, another famous Avaduta, which I already mentioned. When he was, after he died, because he was so attached to that little deer who became a big deer, and he was thinking of the deer at the time of death, he became a deer in his next life, because that's what he was meditating upon at the instant that he left his body. And he was, but nonetheless, he had recollection of his previous life. This is called Jitasvara. One who can recall their previous lives is known as Jitasvara. So Judd Bharat could remember, oh yes, I was this great exalted person in my previous life, and I got attached to this little animal, and now I've taken birth as a deer. So he resolved, no, when this body is over, I am not going to make the same mistake again. It's all right. I mean, everybody, it's all right. You can fall down. I'm not saying you should fall down. But if you fall down, okay, just get back up and pick up where you left off. But don't make the same mistake again. Don't push your luck, as the expression goes, which some of us present company primarily included, meaning me, take advantage of this all the time. Okay, well, Prabhupada's so merciful. All right, I fell down. I did this, I did that. But Prabhupada's so merciful. He promised he's going to take me back to Godhead. I got initiated. So I just pick up until the next fall down. I'll just do everything, and I'll try my best until I fall down again. This can go on, but there's a limit. And at some point, you push your luck a little too far. And then there has to be some rectification. Like later on in this, as we go on in the Bhagavatam, the story of Bali Maharaj is coming up. Now, Bali Maharaj didn't really push his luck because he's Prahlad Maharaj's grandson, but he acquired this enormous, he conquered the universe. Yeah, that's what the greatest demons do. He was a demon devotee, so you can't really refer to him as a demon, even though he took birth in a demonic family. They conquered the universe. When Sudam, the cowherd boy, was cursed by Radharani Krishna was being chastised by Radharani for having flirted with Tulsi Devi, who was known as Viraj. She was a gopi, and she was flirting with Krishna at Krishna's instigation, and Radharani found out about it, and she immediately ran to the scene and caught them, and she cursed Viraj to take birth in the material world. And then she was chastising Krishna, and Sudam was Krishna's best friend, and Sudam's sitting there listening and listening, and he finally, as Krishna's best friend, he said, "Boy, I can't take this anymore," so he intervened, and he made a big mistake, because Radharani said, "Oh, you look, and who do you think you are?" And so she cursed him to take birth in the material world as a demon. I can't remember his name. Sankachuta, right. Sankachuta. So what he did, what he proceeded to do was conquer the universe. All the heavenly, he took over the whole universe. That's what these very empowered deities, demons do. And it's very interesting because when Radharani, Tulsi, she got this benediction from Lord Brahma because she was so exalted. We know Tulsi Devi is so exalted. So when she had taken birth, she immediately left home and went to the Himalayas or Bhadrak Ashram or some holy place and did severe austerities. And so finally Lord Brahma came and asked her, whatever it is you want, please ask me. I'll give you anything you want. The first thing she asked was a mantra to overcome her fear of Radharani. Thought that was very interesting. I didn't want to bring that up on Radharani's appearance there. Thought that might be a little... I didn't want to push my luck by bringing that up, because Radharani does have this... She does arrange for the gopis and to be with Krishna, but sometimes... Sometimes she can get very jealous, and if you get on her bad side, you're in big trouble. So Tulsi asked for a mantra. There is a mantra to overcome fear of Radharani. And the other thing she asked for was that Krishna would become her husband, in the case of Vishnu. This Avaduta was recognized by Prahlad Maharaj, and he would otherwise not speak. Except he knew that Prahlad Maharaj was a very advanced devotee, so he proceeded to explain the philosophy and his position and how to be detached from the material world and how all of our material endeavors are useless, etc., etc. In the same way as Judd Bharat. When he took birth as Judd Bharat in a Brahminical family, he also played deaf and dumb and ignorant. His father tried to teach him how to wash his hands and be clean. Like when he used the restroom, after you use the restroom, wash your hands. Well, Judd Bharat would wash his hands before he used the restroom, and then after he used the restroom, he would just go walking off. And then later on, after his father, who loved him dearly, he was very attached to Judd Bharat. His father was a very, very exalted Brahmin, and took care of him all his life and tried to instruct him, but it was hopeless, because Judd Bharat did not want to be recognized. He did not want to help form any material attachments. He did not. He was finished. He didn't want to take any chances. He said, "I'm not taking any chances. I'm not gonna do anything where I could make the same mistake again." But after his father left, he had these 9 stepbrothers, and these stepbrothers were very cruel and very ignorant. And they would exploit him. They would sell him to farmers to plow and pick and rake the dirt and so forth. And he couldn't even do that. But these brothers were so cruel that they would make money off of him in that way. And so one time, a group of dacoits came along, and they were looking for a sacrifice for Goddess Kali. They wanted to get these benedictions from Kali. And so the brothers sold Judd Bharat, a famous story, to the dacoits. Take our brother. He's useless. He's an animal. They thought he was an animal. He can't talk. He doesn't understand anything. He can't clean himself. He doesn't brush his teeth. You know, give him some worm-filled rice and he'll eat it. He doesn't care. So they sold him to these dacoits. These dacoits were all extremely happy. They washed him up. They cleaned him up. They put him in nice clothes. They put him on the altar in front of Goddess Kali. Took out the machete or the hatchet or the axe or whatever it is they were going to use to slit his throat and offer his blood to Goddess Kali. But, of course, Goddess Kali, being a loyal servant of Krishna, knew what was going on here, and immediately manifested herself in person, and then cut off the head of all the dacoits. And then with her demon friends, they had a party, and they were throwing the heads around like a volleyball game and stuff like that. Anyway, that's not really the point. That was just a little part that some of us enjoy reading to liven up these philosophical issues. Anyway, these avadutas, they choose to be this way because they do not want anyone to know who they are, so that they do not take the chance of falling down again or becoming attracted by something in this material world. So therefore, later on, the avaduta in this case gives the instructions, and I'll end on this point. that we should become like the bumblebee and the python. Because the python is a very unusual creature. If you know anything about pythons, they're very big snakes. They grow 30 to 40 feet long in some cases. They're huge. They can swallow alligators and crocodiles whole. They'll eat a whole crocodile, or these huge animals, and their system is just unreal, the way nature has created these things. And they'll just lay in one place and wait and wait and wait and wait until something comes along. Days and weeks, whatever it takes, they'll just stay in the same spot. When something comes along, they'll grab it and eat it. The bumblebee, on the other hand, bumblebee is always making honey, flying around, taking a drop of honey, bringing it back to the honeycomb, building up this whole honeycomb nest of all this honey. And then as soon as this big, treasure trove of honey is there on the tree or wherever it's hanging, somebody will come along and take it. And so this is compared to the fruit of workers who endeavor with so much difficulty to become successful in the material world. And even if they do become successful, thinking, as Prabhupada says so many times, I've got a big bank account, and I live in this house with all these security cameras, which in this day and age actually catches them committing some kind of crime instead of some other criminal coming in and doing something. It's just like there's all kinds of these reality shows crime shows or criminology shows where these people, murder their wife, murder their husband, do something inside their house, and their own security cameras record what they've done, and in this way they're captured. But they think these things are going to protect them, and these guard services and the big bank account, and I've got a beautiful wife, I've got so many children, I'm protected. But still, the government comes in and takes all their money through taxes, or there's a coup and a new government comes in, or there thieves and dacoits will come and steal their money. So Prabhupada said, even if they are successful in the material world, even if they become very successful, at great pain, with great endeavor, it's not easy to become like that. You have to work very, very hard, and it's full of anxiety. And actually, Prabhupada talks about later on that they can't sleep at night, so they have to take a prescription for some sleeping pill, and even that doesn't work sometimes, Prabhupada points out. And as soon as they get all this accumulated, even if they survive all of these adiatmic, adibhotic, adidaivic types of miseries, well, there's the old fourfold birth, death, disease, and old age. When everything else fails, there's still disease, old age, death, and rebirth. And no one can defeat that. And then, of course, Prabhupada tells the story of, personally knew of a man who was dying, who was begging the medical attendants, just give me 4 more years so I can finish my plans. And, of course, the doctors and the others were not able to do that. And Prabhupada says, and so, therefore, this man died in great bereavement. He uses that expression. He died in great bereavement, great lamentation, great sorrow, because I've spent my whole life. And sometimes we think, and I think, even myself, I think, they're just telling us these stories. The material world is really a good place, and there really is happiness out there, but they're trying to brainwash us to think that there isn't, so they're trying to tell us how bad it is out there. Don't go out there. It's so bad. Even if you get rich and famous, you're still going to be miserable. And I think, they're just saying that. That's just propaganda, to try to keep us in the cult, so we won't leave. And we'll stay here and we'll be afraid of, coming back as a worm in stool in our next life, which is one of the lines we used to use quite frequently in the old days that got us into a little legal difficulty at one point, the worm in stool brainwashing case. But it's true. We accumulate all these things, and then at the end of life, just when we've got everything that we want, and now I'm ready to sit back and enjoy. Now I can enjoy it all. I don't have to work anymore. I can just enjoy all my women and enjoy parties, enjoy my cars, enjoy my pool, enjoy my oceanfront view in Malibu, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Here comes Yamaraj. There's Yamaraj knocking on the door. Time to go. Sorry. Sorry, Charlie. Sorry, Nick, whoever lives out there. Time to go. We have to leave. So what's the point of it all if we just have to give it up all anyway? What is the use? This is what the Avadutas, this is what Prahlad Maharaj teaches us. Why are we working so hard for all of these things? Because when even if we obtain them in a very, very, very brief period of time, we have to give it all up. We're going to lose it all anyway. So the bumblebee is like that. The bumblebee works very hard, builds the honeycomb, only to see it plundered. On the other hand, the python is detached. The python is satisfied with whatever facility is provided by the Lord. If the Lord provides a nice big pig, oh, I'll feast, I'll have a great gourmet dinner. But if nothing else, nothing comes along, then I won't eat at all. So this Avaduta, he was very fat. Actually, he was very fat. And Prahlad Maharaj was, how is it you're so fat? Because normally you get fat when you're successful. And in India particularly, I have heard that it's kind of like prestigious to be fat because that's a sign of success. However, as we'll read later on, Prabhupada said, it is not good for devotees to get fat. It's not good for devotees to get fat because that means they're inactive. That means the devotees are not working. They're not staying active. And they're simply trying to enjoy the Mahaprasadam and living comfortably, etc. So Prabhupada did not like fat disciples. And he said that. And actually, there used to be a lot more fatter disciples, devotees, than there are these days. I think everybody is getting older. We realize that when you get fat, you get certain diseases and medical problems that go along with that. So devotees are actually much more health conscious now than in the old days when the ghee used to just flow out the front door and down the street. And it's not quite like that anymore. But anyway, these Avadutas are very unusual personalities. This whole section of the Bhagavatam is very, very powerful because Prabhupada is describing, next chapter is the ideal householder. So I noticed here this morning, more white than saffron. You've already heard about the sannyasis, and this is the epitome of the sannyasis, the Paramahamsas, who aren't even supposed to carry dandas or this other thing, their water pots or whatever. They're just supposed to be completely inconspicuous. If you think because if you become a householder, you're going to get off the hook, about 15 or 20 pages from now, you're in for a rude awakening. It's not the utopia that we might think it is. It's very strict. Because if one wants to get out of the material world, it's a very difficult thing to do. The process is actually very easy. Just chant the holy name. The Sankirtan movement is very easy to get out of this material world. The process is easy, but the material world is full of all of these traps and these impediments. So, anyway, enough said on that. Does anybody have any questions? Or we can end here. Okay. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.